Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey, everyone. Today, we have the final interview in our month-long series with the Red Hot Chili Peppers in celebration of their new album, Unlimited Love, produced by Rick Rubin. And there's only one Chili Pepper left. Mr. I Eat Drums for Breakfast, Chad Smith. Chad has always been a bit of an outlier in the band. He's the only member who isn't from LA. He's from the Motor City and was reared more on classic rock than punk like the rest of the band. But Chad's an integral member of the Peppers. His hard-hitting style is the foundation of the sound the band's known for. And as we'll hear him tell Rick, Chad fell in love with the Chili Peppers the day he auditioned for them close to 35 years ago. On today's episode, Chad and Rick talk about the lost demo sessions that Chili Peppers recorded nearly a year before making Blood Sugar Sex Magik. Chad also talks about how Californication started out as what he calls a bad reggae song. And he remembers the time he and Flea got chased nearly naked by cops in Green Bay. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin with Chad Smith.
Hi, Rick.
What's happening, Maine?
Good morning.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you. How's the family?
Everybody's good. Everything good on your side?
Yeah, pretty good.
Nice.
Beckett just turned 13. He's a teenager now.
Amazing.
I know. But he's good. He's playing the drums.
What's that like? What's it like seeing your kid play the drums?
Yeah, you know, He played like a while ago, years ago, when he was younger, probably like 9. And then he started to play the piano a little bit. And then he went back to the drums, and he's really embraced it. I got a guy that comes every Sunday, pretty good teacher. And he doesn't like, it's not like written music. Although he can read music, he's really good with numbers and math and stuff, which kind of drumming and that stuff is when you're reading it. There's no melodic notes. But it's cool. He teaches him. He wants to learn songs. So yesterday, he learned the whole intro to War Pigs. And I'm just like in the bedroom. I'm hearing, da-da, 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 I'm like, that sounds like War Pigs. It wasn't Take On Me. It wasn't, you know, Jump. I'm like, that's one of the most epic songs you could ever learn. He got a big smile on his face. Yeah. And he plays open-handed, Rick. He doesn't cross over with the hi-hat. He's right-handed, but he just like naturally, so the hat, he plays the hat on the left and the snare like this, which is great because like I wish I would have learned like that, I suppose, because, I mean, when you're right-handed, you just, you know, your left is here and you lead with your right, except for Ringo, who leads with his fills with the left, but he crosses over. But your right hand is wide open to do, you don't have to get out of the way.
Does anyone play that way?
Yeah.
Any drummers we know? Who's known who plays in that style?
I mean, guys do it that are ambidextrous, like Simon Phillips, you know the drummer Simon Phillips?
Yeah.
He plays open. He can do anything. He's a freak. He can do anything like that. And he does play his hat real low. I mean, it just makes sense.
No, you think about it, like, why cross? I guess the reason the crossing must have started, if we think about it, has to do with the pedal.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the foot that you want to be on the kick drum wants to be that foot.
Right.
Which puts the hi-hat on the left side.
Yeah. Well, yeah, way back when it was the low hat down in New Orleans, when it was just somebody just put the two cymbals together, but just to play with your foot to keep time. And then I don't know who, but somebody smartly thought, well, let's bring it up so you can hit it with the stick. So yeah, that left foot still stayed over there. And if you're right-handed, you just ended up going over here. And then if you're Levon or Charlie Watts, you got out of the way. Dun, dun, ka, dun, 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 ka, dun, 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 ka. But the open thing, I'm like, you got to give me some lessons.
I didn't realize Levon did that as well. I know Charlie's famous for that.
Yeah. Well, I asked Charlie once about that, and I thought he was doing it from the very beginning, but he wasn't. He told me that he saw Levon when the band was playing with Dylan. Were they the Hawks back then?
Yeah, but they were the Hawks, and then when they started playing with Dylan, they became the band.
But they did a tour with him in England. I think it's the famous, when somebody yells out Judas, when he came out, did acoustic, when he went electric, and people were booing and freaking out. And I think Charlie said he saw that, and Levon was doing that, was getting out of the way, and he went, oh.
So Charlie got it from Levon. That's an incredible bit of trivia.
That's what he told me, but he was kind of fuzzy about it. But he said, I saw him do it, and I said, oh, I'll try that, you know, get out of the way. Just to get a bigger, stronger backbeat. But it's such a sound and such a feel thing.
Yeah. And I assume it has to affect the hi-hat hits as well, but both the last one before you pull away and the first one when you come back has to have some impact on those if it's just not all...
Constant.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lope to it, and then there's that space, obviously, that it leaves when not having the hat and the snare together that makes the snare land and sound like it lands in a certain way. I mean, I've done it, but I'm thinking about it, which is never a good thing for me to be thinking about it while you're playing. But once it's just second nature, I mean, Charlie's, he's the king of it. But what was the thing Levon was doing at Woodstock in the later years? It was just him and his family.
Yeah, yeah.
It was called, like, it was at the barn there. I did get to go up there and see them play and got to sit in with him. And it was incredible. He's singing, you know, he had the operation on his throat. He was still a little raspy, but he was so sweet and kind. And it was, I'd never seen him in person, up close or anything, and to see him play and one of a kind, you know, amazing.
When he played, was the groove, did it sound like Levon? Like, was it
100%? You close your eyes, that's him. It's amazing.
How different is that, closing your eyes, the personality of different drummers for people who are less tuned into listening specifically to drummers? How obvious is it, the difference between drummers?
Yeah. In rock and roll, not being a melodic instrument used as support and as rhythm, I think it might be more difficult to hear, other than style, but a sound. Like, certainly certain drummers, John Bonham has a specific sound. Phil Collins, when you hear his drumming, you know it, Tim. He has a specific sound. Stuart Copeland's style of drumming, definitely, you know it's him. There's a lot. You know, Keith Moon, I think the personality comes out through your instrument. And I think maybe it's a little harder on the drums, again, because it's not such a melodic instrument. But I'm more, you know, being a drummer, I'm more in tune. Like, there's guys that you know right off the bat, and then you could hear all those great pop hits from the 70s that Hal Blaine played on, and he would morph into whatever scene he was in and whatever music, and he was just playing for the song. And it wasn't necessarily a sound, but there's a thing that he did that was so special that made all those records so special. But I didn't know that was Hal Blaine until years later. Mm-hmm. My brother worked with him, and they put out a book, and he worked with them, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, like every song that I ever listened to as a kid, basically, Hal played the drums on. And, you know, he was a chameleon. So probably the most in rock and roll, to me, the most recognizable would be probably John Bonham, you know, because it's just sound and that music and the way that he played. I didn't hear much. I've heard Band of Joy. I'm trying to think of other situations where Bonham had played not in Led Zeppelin. There's not a lot out there.
There's the Donovan song that's very clearly John Bonham when you know it.
And does it sound like him and his drums?
Oh, absolutely.
Did Page produce it?
Well, Page plays, it's Page.
Is it Hurdy-Gurdy Man? No.
It must be Hurdy-Gurdy Man.
Because I know he played on that.
It must be Hurdy-Gurdy Man. And they played together pre-Led Zeppelin.
Right. Well, I mean, I the one that I heard, it was like a PJ Proby.
Yeah.
And I think Zeppelin had formed, hadn't done any recording, and there was a session that John Paul Jones and Page had to do for this guy, for his singer, I believe he's a singer. And so that was the first time that they recorded together. And it sounds like Bonham because you know like his grooves and his musical choices and stuff, but the sound of the drums is not that big ambient thing yet. But how great, Rick, is it that here's a kid, and I call him a kid. He was a teenager, 19 years old, making the first Led Zeppelin record. And right out of the box, first song, first Good Times, Bad Times, and he's doing the triplets with his feet, the sound of the drums, the whole thing was a fully realized, I mean, obviously he went on and changed and grew, but like right from the get-go, that's rare. That's like Tony Williams with Miles, you know, 17, like a fully formed musician at such a young age. That amazed me, but like Bonham just came out like doing his thing. I listened to your podcast with Robert Plant.
Yeah, interesting, right? We learned so much.
Great.
I loved it.
He was an MC?
Yeah.
At the little dance halls? It was amazing.
Amazing.
But him saying, meeting Bonham, and Bonham saying, I'm the greatest drummer in the world. Like, not lacking any confidence at all. But, you know, that's just like, you have your thing, and then obviously you have Jimmy Page and being able to capture that and knowing, you know, oh, I've got a thing here. This is what I got to do. And back then, as you know, everybody jammed the mics up into the toms and took the heads off and he said, no, the air. And that was his sound, and boom.
Do we know anything about Bonham's influences?
Only from what I've read. I talked to Jason a little bit, too. I asked him about it. But a lot of Motown, funk stuff, like that it makes sense. He loved Motown, loved James Brown. He said that his dad loved there's a drummer, kind of a fusion guy named Alphonse Musance, who's a fusion drummer in the 70s, kind of a Billy Cobham type. And he says dad loved those records, would play them constantly at home. More R&B funk kind of stuff, part of it, you know, which is interesting to me because people think of Led Zeppelin as being a heavy band, and John Bonham's just a real loud, hard-hitting drummer. But it was the finesse that he had. And that's what people sort of, I think, miss when they play those songs, or maybe a Bill Ward in Black Sabbath, the heaviest band. But he was like a jazz drummer playing behind that stuff. He wasn't bashing.
Yeah. No, and both of them were ultra groovy. Like
yes.
Ultra groovy drummers.
Swinging.
Swinging away. It was never straight. For me, it's interesting early listening to, I liked heavy music when I was young, but I always preferred swinging heavy music to straight heavy music. So the Iron Maidens and the Judas Priests of the world never spoke to me in the way that Led Zeppelin or Aerosmith or any of the ones that were more AC/DC, where as straight as AC/DC was, it was always groovy. It never felt straight. As straight as it was, it never felt straight.
Right. To me, that's the key for that kind of music, like that kind of rock and roll, is it has to have that swing to it. And a lot of those English drummers, like the Ian Paces and the Mitch Mitchells and obviously the Ginger Bakers, you hear their jazz influence in their playing. And because at their house, that's what they were listening to, their parents or whatever, that was the music of the day before skiffle and other stuff came along. But then they started listening to the Chuck Berry and the R&B stuff, and that all was like swinging stuff. That wasn't straight. That was, they straightened it out as much as they could. You know, Earl Palmer's all of a sudden started playing straight eights, and it was, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I got a backbeat too, not just on the shout chorus. I'm going to do a backbeat through the whole song. And then they just took that with this loud, heavy blues music and like, that's the swing behind it. And that, I mean, that makes you dance. That makes you bop your head and tap your feet. And so I listened to a lot of those guys growing up. I had an older brother, and that's the music that I listened to, those bands from the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, the ones we've been talking about. And all those drummers had that swingy thing. So, you know, I kind of just lucked out loving that music and trying to emulate those drummers.
Was drums your first instrument, first thing you ever picked up to play?
Yeah, it would be ice cream tubs, those, you know, the you'd scoop the ice cream out of, made of cardboard, and spoons. I had an older brother and older sister, and she played piano, my brother played guitar, and so I just wanted to hit stuff. Anything, you know, the usual pots and pans and stuff around the house. But yeah, that was my first drum set, would be the Baskin Robbins. My dad put a bunch of black tape on them. I went through those pretty quick. And then I think there was a store called Kresge's, kind of like a Kmart store. And I got a little drum set that came in a box, but paper heads and had a little triangle and a little tin cymbal. Went through that pretty quick. And then saved up enough money from, grew up outside of Detroit, so it was mowing lawns and shoveling snow, and got enough money. If my parents said, if you get half of the money, we'll put up the other half. And I bought, and I got a Slingerland kit for $160. So I had $80 of getting up before school. But then it was like,
it was on.
Oh my God. Gold sparkle Slingerland.
Wow, beautiful.
Yeah. Sold it for a bag of weed in high school, though.
Oh, I was just going to say, if you still had that.
I had it. No.
Gold sparkles. Perfect.
I know. I got one at home now. It's just like, it's not the one. But yeah, but that was great. And then it was off to the headphones and putting on records like Chicago. I loved Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. Early Chicago. The early Chicago is unbelievable.
It was amazing. Terry Kath, incredible. So that drummer, Danny Seraphine, and so I played to those records, and then anything that my brother had, you know, he would be upset with me because, don't touch my records.
Do you remember any of the weirder records he had?
Yeah. My first, then I bought 45s, Vic, like when I was like 8 years old and 9 years old. So I started playing at seven. So eight or nine, I would buy 45s. And God, and I think about it now, I was like some kind of record guy. And they would give a little chart. You go by the record, and they had the charts. And there was this station outside of Detroit in Windsor called CKLW, the Motor City. But they weren't in the Motor City. They were across the river. Anyway, I would listen to that station at night, going to bed. My mom's like, "God, good night." I'm like, "Good night, Mom." And I'm put the radio on, bent down, and that seeped into my subconscious, I'm sure. But it was all AM, you know, hits of the day. But you would hear Sly and Family Stone next to Jackson 5, next to Spirit in the Sky by Norman Greenbaum, like whatever that 70s Melanie, Lay Down, Stay Down, all that stuff. So there was this song, it was a novelty song called The Groovy Grubworm that came on, and it was, I want to say Harlow Wilcox, you know, to check, but a long time ago. And so it was just this country funk kind of thing, all instrumental. Then in the middle of the song, there was a little drum kind of wipeout break, and the guy would go, "I'm a grubworm." And then, and I thought that was the greatest thing ever. I would speed it up. I would slow it down. And it drove my family crazy. I wore out Groovy Grubworm.
Amazing.
So, yeah, that was weird. But, I would buy those 45s, and I had a good stack of them. I don't know where they are anymore. And I would go, and then they would give a little sheet, like a little small, wasn't even a full piece of paper, and it was the charts, the CKLW charts. And I remember War, Good God, Joe, Edwin Starr, and I loved that song. It was so heavy.
Incredible.
And I bought the record, and I would go back the next week, and it would go up to number 6. With a star, and then it would go up to number 4. I was like rooting for War, and it got to 2 on CKLW or whatever. But I was like, wow, I'm really invested in this thing. It's really amazing.
So it wasn't just the love of music went beyond the drumming, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, early on, for sure, it was like the pop stuff. And obviously, growing up in Detroit, lots of Motown, which was very prevalent in the late 60s. That was great. And but you just kind of know what you like. And I didn't know, I wasn't necessarily listening to the drumming for it. It felt good to me. I loved it. I just loved the music, and it didn't really matter. Later, when I started to get into the Led Zeppelins and the Sabbaths and the Mitch Mitchells and those guys, then I started, when I could had a little more facility on the drums, and I started to really listen to the drumming and all that stuff. But at the beginning, it was just love of music.
What was the first band that you joined as a kid?
My brother and I had a band called, we moved to Chicago in 1970, and we had a band called Rockin' Conspiracy.
Good name.
Not rocking.
Rockin'.
Mm-hmm. You know, Watergate. We were very, wow. We were
political.
Very political 12-year-olds. And we worked up the songs of the day. We had Lane Linder on the Farfisa. We had Dave Stender on the custom, remember those custom bass amps that looked like those bicycle seats that were padded?
Yeah. Was it a black one or a blue sparkle?
I think it was a silver sparkle.
Oh, silver sparkle.
Which, but like he'd bought it from some bar band. It was like yellow sparkle from all the smoke. And my brother had a very out of tune guitar, and we sounded really bad. And we played Fire by Jimi Hendrix. We played Light My Fire by The Doors. We played bad versions of Stairway to Heaven. And then we would do Country Roads. We kind of played the hits of the day, and we were hired by our junior high school to play the junior high school dance class. So we go, and we're like really excited. We're going to play all of our songs. We play our songs pretty bad, and the kids are trying to dance. It's going okay. And then about 20 minutes into it, she says, "Well, we need to do the foxtrot. So you guys have a song in 3. We had no songs in 3. You're out. We got the boot. Rock Conspiracy had one game. Now, we would play in our basement, like my parents would have parties. But one public gig, so to speak, couldn't do anything in 3.
Done. Next.
Out. Find us a foxtrot band.
Do you remember the first song you learned in 3?
Breaking the Girl. No. that's a good question. Yeah. I love playing in 3. I wish I would have learned early on. That's one of the, I could do okay because it's got such a swing to it, you know? No, I, you know, that's, you know, it had to have been a popular song of the day that was in three.
Yeah, I'm sure something. There was.
Yeah.
Like before that, like Babies in Black would have been, but that would have been too early.
Right.
And it wasn't really a hit. It was just, but still, Beatles, every Beatles song seemed like a hit.
Every Beatles song, right.
And then any other bands as you were growing up? And when did you decide to come to L.A.?
Yeah, then I just like through school, high school, and then I started playing in bands. I always played with guys who were older than me, mm-hmm. which was always good because that kind of pushed you and maybe they were, you know, better. And but once I got to high school, sports went away. And it was more, you know, girls and you know, it was drug, sex, and rock and roll for me from 10th grade on. I was like, I'm not that good at baseball, and you know, but you know, I could play this backyard party and with my band Paradise.
How was Paradise? Tell me about that one.
Paradise. We were a little heavier. We would do Cream and maybe some Rush songs, and of course, growing up in Detroit in the late 70s, Ted Nugent and Robin Trower, Hendrix. And we were a three-piece, and the guitar player, nickname was Gloves McClintock. He was from Texas, and it, being cold in Detroit, he would always have ski gloves on all the time. He always wore his ski gloves in school. He had the comb. Do you remember the guys in school, Rick, that had the comb, brush comb? It kind of went around your thing, and you could slick your hair back and then put it in your back pocket of your corduroy Levi's?
Yes.
That was Gloves McClintock. That was his look. And he was kind of crazy. He was an alcoholic in high school. He'd come out at lunchtime and drink a bunch of vodka. He was crazy. Texas crazy guy. I would be shocked if he's still alive. I hope he is. But he was a really good guitar player.
I bet.
He could rip. And so we played one battle of the bands, and we actually won. I mean, maybe the competition wasn't so good, but we were okay.
Yeah.
We were pretty good. But then I had sold my Gold Sparkle, and I was going through my Rush phase, so I wanted to have my Neil Peart set up with the cowbells and all the bells and whistles that some drummers go through when you can sort of play a bunch of stuff. You want to do it all the time.
I'm so glad you got rid of that kid.
I know you are. Rick is, for our lovely listeners, Rick's, when we're doing sessions and or whenever recording, I'll do something and he'll say, did you always do that? Well, no. Well, maybe just a crash. That's good enough. Bop, boom. That's for live. You could do that.
Yeah. That seems more like the live version. You don't want to hear that over and over on a record. It's true. Too distracting.
Keep it simple.
It is distracting.
You're 100% right. But us drummers, we, you know, you want to get in your lick here and there. I learned that. But when I was in Paradise, I was all up, but look, oh my God, he could go from all the way around and touch them all.
Yeah, like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Emerson, Lake, and terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me. Yeah. So I did that. But yeah, then, you know, right out of high school, played in a bunch of bands in Detroit, played all the bars six nights a week, three sets a night.
That's an interesting thing we can talk about is cover bands, because I don't know that that's something that really exists anymore, but when we were growing up, and I don't know if it was the case in Detroit as much as it was where I grew up in Long Island, but there was a whole circuit of clubs that cover bands would play at, and they would tour around and come around, and then certain bands kind of grew out of that, like Twisted Sister was a band that started that way, and then they became Twisted Sister. I believe Aerosmith grew out of that world of being a cover band.
Van Halen
was a cover band.
Yep.
But that we don't see that as much anymore.
I know. Maybe you're probably right, but that's exactly what the scene was like in Detroit for me. There were probably seven or eight clubs in the Tri-County area, and you were a cover band. You could sneak in your originals here and there. Not too many. You don't want to clear out the dance floor for too long.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. We played, and there was a very vibrant circuit, and there were lots of bands that played them. I'm trying to think of any groups at that time that came out of that, that graduated to being, you know, getting signed and national actor, but not that I remember, but there were a lot of bands. You put on your own records and you were local rock guys. And I had a band called Toby Red, and we played, literally, that's where I really got my 10,000 hours, so to speak. I mean, it was, and Rick, I loved it. I was 18, right out of high school. I'm playing bars. I'm staying out late, girls and beer and rock. It was like, I made it.
Yeah.
I'm a professional musician.
Yeah.
I'm getting paid $165 a week.
Yeah, at 18.
I was living at home.
Yeah, at 18 in the 80s. It was a lot. Was that amazing. Was a lot of money.
It was great.
Yeah.
I was like, did I want to be in Led Zeppelin? Of course. But like, this is what I wanted to do.
And it beat having any other job.
Oh, kidding me? Those stiffs working? You have to get up? I'm sleeping till 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I loved
it. You never looked back, did you? Was there ever a time
No,
that...
I never got a job.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I couldn't.
Yeah, I understand.
I couldn't. I there's nothing else that I'm remotely good at.
Yeah.
I mean, and I luckily, like we've been talking, I found my passion at 7 or 8, and I did other things. I did sports and stuff, but no one was making me go play music or play the drums. I wanted to. I loved it. And that's so lucky. I mean, amazing. You know, my kids, they like stuff, but they don't have a real focus yet, and that's fine. Everybody will find their path, but I found it early, man. I tell you, I lucked out in that way, 100%. And I was happy doing it, you know, and then 8 years went by, and then the guys in my group were getting a little bit older, and they're married, and they got little houses, and we're still kind of plugging along. Things went up, things went down, you know, had a record come out, and da-da-da, and at a certain point, I was like, I probably got to make a move. I got to go to where the music is. No one's going to come to the side street lounge in Linkin Park and go, oh, you're the drummer for Guns N' Roses or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So it was either New York or L.A. I had some friends that had moved to L.A. L.A.'s much warmer. I'd had enough of the cold weather.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sunset Strip was going off and MTV and, like I said, the Guns N' Roses and all that. And I was like, I'm going to go there, see what happens.
And what year was that?
1988, August of 1988. Packed up, yeah, like the Beverly Hillbillies, and drove across country with my brother, God bless him, who lived in San Francisco. And I slept on my friend's couch, and that was August. And I joined the Chili Peppers in December of that year, like 6 months later.
We're going to take a quick break here, but we'll be right back with more from Chad Smith and Rick Rubin. We're back with more of Rick Rubin's conversation with Chad Smith.
What's the first time you ever heard of the Chili Peppers?
In 1985, George Clinton did their second record in Detroit. And I was in another band in the early 80s, and the percussionist from that group was Larry Fratangelo, who was the percussionist for P-Funk. So he played on Freaky Styley.
Wow.
He played percussion on some of the songs on Freaky Styley. And I would see Larry from time to time. And so probably 87, we were hanging out. And I said, what you been doing? Oh, I did this session for George. He's crazy kids from California. And da-da-da-da-da. You might like it. And he played me some of it. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Yeah, you know, pretty good. And that was it. First it came on my radar. Later, I had some friends that were definitely loved the Chili Peppers. My friend Newt Cole, who actually kind of got me the gig, and
this was still in Detroit, or no? You already?
It was still in Detroit.
Yeah,
I was still in Detroit towards the so probably sometime in '88. He went and saw them at a club in Detroit. And he told me about it. He loved it. And he was, you know, he was pretty crazy. And I got on stage like 6 times and was diving at St. Andrew's Hall, you know, that kind of stuff. And they had like, Anthony had like coffee cups on his like jacket. It was so weird and stuff like that. I was like, really? Oh, okay. But again, like not, I didn't have any records, anything. Oh, the guys with the socks on their dicks. Yeah, I've heard of them. Yeah, okay, great. And when that's when the call came to do it, I was like, do they have a record deal? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, great, I'll try out for them. Great. That's all that mattered to me. But he was like, you will love this. They are just, you will love this. They just do it all. It's hard. It's great. It's this, it's that. They're crazy. You know, oh, okay. And that was it.
It's interesting for a band that has a reputation, or at least had a reputation, of being so crazy. The level of musicianship is so high compared to anybody else.
Yeah. Well, that, you know what, that's one of the things that I was somewhat taken aback when I for the first audition. There's this place in Silver Lake, I'm sure is no longer, called Hully Gully, which is a little rehearsal place. And the woman, Denise Zoom, Billy Zoom's ex-wife, and if I gotta connect the dots here, was going out some way. They were friendly with my friend Newt, who had told me about the Chili Peppers in California. Denise knew John Frusciante, and so she knew the Chili Peppers were looking for a drummer. And so Newt told Denise, I got your guy, he's from Detroit, he eats drums for breakfast. This is what she told Denise, who told John. So I show up to Hully Gully, and I'm bringing in my drums, and I got my long hair and my bandana. You remember the look?
Yes.
And this is 1988, and, you know, cut off shorts. And the other guys at this point, unbeknownst to me, they're very, you know, the aesthetic was important. You know, you had to have the right mohawk and haircut and tattoos. And, you know, they didn't really like the Sunset Strip kind of thing. And I come in with my Detroit rock thing. They're like, oh, get this guy out of here. Oh, God. And I'm like 6'3", and they're not 6'3".
Yeah. It'd be like the Mods and the Rockers. You know, it was just like a different, different in-group, you know, different.
Right. Sharks and the Jets.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit, but still under the same umbrella. Mm-hmm. And so Flea says, is that your breakfast? And I'm like, what? So I bring my drums in. We set up. And yeah, I remember John was 18 at the time. Young John Frusciante with a big, long black mohawk and a Steve Vai Ibanez guitar. And Anthony was there. Everybody was there. And Michael Beinhorn, who had produced Uplift, the record before Mother's Milk, was there as well. You know, he was just hanging in the back. So I set up and we start playing. And everything was fast and hard. Everything was popping in fast and super fast. James Brown on speed. And I was like, these guys are good. Wow.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm digging in and like I'm like going for it, and then I'm like double timing, and they're like, whoa, and that was the first time. I remember he was like, no, the other drummers, we kind of led them. You were kind of like leading us, and I was like, I'm just going for it. This is fun. Yeah. It was fun. And Anthony was running around. We were just jamming, and he was laughing his ass off. Like, and I'm like, what is so funny? But he just thought it was so ridiculous. Like, what was happening musically was this big explosion. Yeah. And he was just, ah! And then Binor's just sitting in the corner. We jam, and it was great. And we might have even done Higher Ground or something. So he's just, because we were trying to do something. I didn't really know any of their songs.
Yeah.
I listened to the cassette tape. So long ago it was, in the car. This is how much I put into it. I probably should have been a little more prepared. I waited till the parking lot, and I put my cassette in of the Abbey Road EP, and I went, okay, all right, that's cool, Funky Crime. Okay, I could do that. Oh, they do Fire by Jimi Hendrix. I've been doing that with Rock and Conspiracy. And then a couple of their songs, Fight Like a Brave. So I went in, and I was like, all right, you know, we'll see what happened. If they were this big, you know, famous band, I probably would have been, oh, you know, more nervous or did more homework. But I was just kind of going in. And so we're jamming, and John breaks a string. And I've never seen anyone change a string faster in my life. Throws a guitar in the ground. And I was just like, whoa. He just didn't want to miss out on the jam.
Wow.
Yeah, we were just... It was really, God, so long ago. It's amazing. But we play a couple of their songs, and then I leave. Hey, thanks, man, you know, and we'll call you, typical stuff. Yeah, yeah. And Beinhorn went to the guys, and they were like, what do you think? And he goes, that's your guy. They're like, what? The hair and the thing and the what? That's your guy.
Yeah.
Beinhorn, just boom, who notoriously hard on drummers. Yeah. He'll replace a drummer out of a band and say, I know, he's called me. And he was like, telling you, that's the guy. And Anthony's, I don't know. Flea was kind of on board. I think John was on board. Anthony's, I don't know, you know. So I don't remember how long it went by, a couple weeks maybe. And they left a message, this again, 1988, on my answering machine.
Yeah.
At the house I was staying at, hey, it's Flea and Anthony from Chili Peppers. Yeah, if you want, we want you in the band, but you have to shave your head. We'll see you on Monday. I'm not shaving my head. I have these beautiful Detroit locks I've been working on since the 80s.
Yeah.
So I show
I bet
up.
You wish you still had them.
I had to wear a wig the other day for the video we did for These Are the Ways. I was like, I haven't had the bangs since 84, long ago. And so I'm like, I'm not fucking shaving my head. What the fuck are these guys? So I show up and, hey, don't shave your head. I'm like, no. They're like, okay, we respect that.
So from the first time you played with them, forgetting the stylistic difference, were they different than everyone you've ever played with before?
Yes. It was really intense. Like, as soon as we started playing, and I don't know if it was like, they were like, you know, you're fishing and you, oh, we got a one on the line kind of thing. I don't know if it was like, because I was bringing it and equaling it to the energy kind of thing or not, if they play like that all the time. I had no idea. I'd never played with these guys. I don't even think that there was no television thing of them, you know, that I knew of. I mean, I'm sure there was a video, but like, no, Flea was really like, wow.
Yes.
No, I've never heard that.
Yeah.
That was very unique.
Yeah.
Never heard that. That I was like, fuck yeah, this is fucking great. I could do this all day.
You'd say it was a great experience.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wanted to be in the band badly.
Yeah, yeah.
It was hard, but it was like groovy and soulful. It wasn't metal. I could see that like it had the possibility, even back then when everything was, we were kind of still going pretty hard. Like they had good musical taste.
Yeah.
You know, just from a little bit that we talked and what kind of music do you like and that kind of stuff. And yeah, definitely I was like, this is not Toby Redd in Detroit. this is like something else. Yeah.
And even at 18, was John fully formed as John?
No, to me. And he would I would say this if he was sitting next to me, I think that Red Hot Chili Peppers was his favorite band. And so at 18, I think he was kind of more emulating what he thought a Chili Pepper guitar player should be, maybe as in Hillel. A la Hillel.
Yeah.
And there was definitely some of that. And I've heard him say, I know he would say that. So not until Rick, we started, I would say, writing for Blood Sugar, and we had toured and we were a band and we were pretty solid by then. And once we started writing for the Blood Sugar stuff, then I started to hear what as we know as John, you know, more melodic, his own voice. And he just matured. He just grew up, you know, a little bit and figured it out and wanted to do his own thing and become his own musician. So yeah, I think he was, I mean, he had the facility, but he didn't have his voice yet.
It makes sense. It makes sense also age-wise. Like, didn't have enough experience for it to be.
He'd never been in a band before.
Yeah.
Never been in a band. 18 years old, you join your favorite band.
Yeah, you play like you're in the band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas I just kind of, you know, I'd had a lot of experience and I just kind of did me.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I don't think, and this right around the same time, that's why I think Blood Sugar is such a special record, is that that was the first time that I felt like, okay, this sounds, this more has more of a personality to it. This sounds like, you know, the whole band, obviously, but that sounds more like me. When I hear myself play, that sounds like me. And that was, you know, the way it was recorded and the songs and everything and other people playing along as well. But like, okay, that felt like, often you come back in the control room and you're like, that, I don't know, that doesn't sound anything like what I thought it was going to be. It happens. But you know, I would walk in and go, shit, that sounds fucking better.
Yeah. It's amazing when it happens, right? When you can play something and then you play it, you hear it back and you're surprised by how good it is.
Oh.
It's amazing.
Nothing better.
Nothing better.
Nothing better. Then you're way ahead of the game.
Yeah.
No, and we've had that experience many, many times, you know, me and you. But like, yeah, that was a magical time for sure. Well, people often ask, like, what's your favorite Chili Peppers record? And often because of many things, and probably sentimentally 30 years ago, but us really finding our thing.
Yeah.
And working with you.
There's an interesting story about that album that we never talk about, but it's interesting, which is the band was leaving their label.
Correct.
And moving to another label. And we were originally planning on recording, I think, almost a year earlier than we did.
Close to it.
But because of the switch in labels, we couldn't record. We weren't allowed yet to record the album. And instead of it being a negative of, oh, we're going to get stale waiting a year, we kept writing. And we continued, and we ended up writing essentially, you know, more than 2-3 albums worth of material that may not have happened had it not been for that. And because of that experience and because it went so well, that's been more the model that the band has used ever since, where we tend to write way more than an album material.
Yeah.
And in some ways, if you record 4 albums of material and then picking the best of that for your one album, it's going to be that much better. It has to be. It's just the odds of it have to be better. So again, not through any decision of our own, really, the conditions set up something for us to really overwrite in a way that we might not have.
Yeah.
And it ended up becoming part of the playbook now forever.
That's right. Yeah. We were contractually still EMI'd. And I mean, we wrote, I know for sure we wrote, but the song Blood Sugar Sex Magik was definitely after. Sir Psycho was not fully formed, even until we got into the studio.
Yeah.
And I remember Anthony still working out. I mean, musically, we had to kind of get it all arranged. That was, I don't even know if that was around or an idea. It might have been, but it wouldn't have gotten finished.
Yeah.
And you were just like, keep writing. We're like, no, we got 12. We're good. No, keep writing. Yeah,
because you never know. You never know.
And lots of times, as we both know, the best shit comes at the end.
Yeah.
Unexpectedly for us.
What I've noticed is that you just keep writing until you're written out, wherever that is. You know, when the songs stop being good,
right?
That's the time to stop. But not before that. If the last song you wrote was your best song, you got to keep writing because the well's not, you know, you're, because right. they won't always be flowing. That's the other part of it. It's like, we never know. So when they're flowing, get them all. Because no years later, when it's time to do it again, who knows if they're going to be flowing, and they won't be those same songs.
Right.
You know, you'll never get those again. So it's the only chance to go mining, you know?
100%. And I love that. And you can think, that's it. I got it. Okay. That's all I can't do anything after that. That's it. I'm dry. Nah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Nah, that's probably sparked something else that will make something probably that you didn't think you could do.
Yeah.
Do. And I've seen that many times.
Yes.
And that's a beautiful thing. But Rick, you know, you have to have someone that can, like, you know, point that out and be like, no, keep going. And then almost like doing takes, you do 3, 4, and then number 5, and you're like, I think we've hit the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not getting
better.
Let's stop.
Yeah. Let's either take a break.
Take a break.
Or come back to it another time, because it rarely turns around. Once it goes up and peaks and then starts going the other way, very difficult to recover.
Do you find that be the case working with other people as well?
Everybody. With everybody.
Yeah. But see, the Beatles would do fucking 68. I know they're writing it and arranging it while they're doing it. They're not full takes. But like, I read stuff about it and they're like, yeah, we used, you know, the basic track was take 34 or something.
Yeah. But they also, that was happening also really quickly because their sessions were so short and the songs had just been written. Like the week before the song was written, the band had never heard the songs before they started recording. Only John and Paul knew them.
Yeah.
Which is radical to imagine. It's radical.
And that music. And oh, I'm going to come up with this part. Doom, doom.
Yeah. In the moment.
Really?
In the moment.
In the moment.
Yeah.
Fucking amazing.
That's why they're the Beatles and then everybody else is everybody else.
I'm not comparing us to that. I just think about that because to me, yeah, I'm the same way and I know so many other bands and you just said that. It's never happened with you. And it's three or four times and then if you haven't gotten it, you move on.
Yeah. There are some bands, I will say, that keep getting better over takes. So it might not be three or four. For some bands, it might be 12 or 15 before it turns down where that peak. But when it happens, it's very clear when it happens. It's very, very clear when now by playing it more, it's diminishing returns. It's not like getting better. It's only getting worse. Right. And as soon as that happens, it only gets frustrating. So it's better to let's play something else. There's another thing that I just thought about that we haven't talked about in a long time and would be interesting to listen to now in retrospect. Because of what happened with Blood Sugar and that 2-year period of not being able to, from the time we started until we recorded, instead of it being 9 months or a year, that extra year, I remember I went into A&M to do a remix of a Queen song and you came in to play drums on it, on the remix.
Yes.
And then I remember, so legally we're not allowed to record, but we had this studio for Queen. So
the Nike Sessions. Or whatever it was.
I don't know what it was called. But I called everyone and just said, hey, can you guys come down here? And we recorded whatever version we were up to in that moment of all of the Blood Sugar songs, probably a year before we recorded the album. And that exists somewhere. Probably.
Where's that?
It exists somewhere. We could try to find that. But I've never heard it since. I never thought about it until we just have this conversation.
I haven't thought about that in a way long time. I mean, I was so jazzed. You're like, I think the Queen had signed a Hollywood record.
Yes.
And they were having people do remixes to put the record out. And Rick was like, you know, and I think Flea played on it too. At the end, we jammed out at the end of We Will Rock You. And Rick did a remix of it up front. And then when the guitars come in, we just play and played out and it was great. But I remember it was late at night ish.
Yeah.
And the other guys came in, or John came in.
Yeah.
I don't know if Anthony was there or not, but did we do it like live?
Did we do it all together? I think so. I think we did it like kind of like a tracking session, but we only played the songs once, maybe in some cases twice, but I think mostly once. So and back then we weren't as proficient as now. So I will say it'll be
a little rough.
It'll be rough, but it'll be fun to listen to.
Oh, my God, because I'm sure some of the parts and the arrangements and stuff were different.
Yeah, different. Definitely evolved.
I've forgotten about that. You're right.
Trip, right?
That's the box set from Anthology Blood Sugar Demos.
Yeah, Blood Sugar Demos. In a way, that's probably what it is. And, you know, I think if we listen back, I don't know if they exist anywhere, but we always had demos of everything during the making of the albums. You know, just the recordings of the rehearsals where we would listen to them and then talk about the parts. Let's try changing this, you know, changing the arrangements.
Yeah.
So those exist somewhere. DATs. Remember, we always had DATs of the...
They were DATs.
Of all the rehearsals.
Yeah.
And the rehearsals were the writing sessions, essentially, right?
Yeah. I mean, either at the Swing House, but we did so much stuff at the Alley.
The Alley. And we recorded all that.
All that.
Yeah.
We did almost for every record up until, I mean, Stadium, we wrote tons at the Alley. Yeah, we would record them. The Dats. Where are the Dats?
Yeah, we've never looked.
Rick, let me ask you, what did you think about doing, I mean, we've done all of our records with you to tape. How was it working with tape? No big deal?
No big deal for me.
Good.
Yeah, it doesn't matter at all.
Other than we couldn't, remember in the Stadium, tape was hard to find.
Yeah.
Remember there's three reels in Green Bay and it was like trying to get drugs or something. It was like trying to find,
This one too. This one, but we were on it and we had experts searching the globe for tape.
Right. But we still went over stuff, which back in the day we never did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We never did.
I mean, there'd be boxes up to the ceiling, but.
I'm hoping that I don't know if this is true, but I'm hoping we have a digital version of everything we went over. I hope. Mm. It would be good if that exists.
We should. I would think.
I hope so. Just, it's always cool to document stuff. You never know. It's fun to listen to someday. How did a song get to the version that we ended up using? The evolution, even in the studio, because sometimes they change quite a bit when recording, they evolve.
I mean, the song Californication is a perfect example of a song evolving. And again, one of the rare songs that Anthony had words for before he had heard any music. It was basically like poetry,
wrote it like a poem.
He wrote like a poem, like Under the Bridge.
Yeah.
He had these lyrics, and we were trying to come up with music to it. And we did a session early on and before Californication came. It was again in like another demo session at Teatro in Oxnard, this little studio up there. And I'd heard a version of Californication that we did there. It was like reggae, like bad reggae version.
Wow.
It was not, I mean, you could hear the melody and but the music, and do you remember we worked on it and like, no, it's just not coming together. Anthony wasn't feeling it. You weren't feeling it, I think. And then finally, I think it was towards the end. Was it towards the end of this of recording? Or no, it was definitely him showing up with the simple chords when we were at Ocean Way or East West. And that song, you know, talking about like going and hearing different versions of songs and like learning from, I mean, if we would have gave up on that, I'm glad it's perseverance of like, there's a song in there somewhere.
Yeah.
There's a good song in there somewhere. We just have to find the right approach.
Yeah. Sometimes it's as simple as the approach.
Yeah.
The wrong approach can sink a great song.
Right. And up to that point, it was almost like, oh, well, we're not going to get that one. But, you know, John came in that one day with the chords and it all came together. And it's like, I think it's our most popular song now. Something like that. Yeah. Crazy. It almost wasn't. So persevere, kids.
Yeah. How would you say the band has changed from the band that you joined to the band today? Talk about the evolution of the band.
Wow. That's 34 years almost now. For me, you know, God, we've had mainly and Anthony since 1988, but different guitar players come, and we've had some great musicians, Dave Navarro and Josh Klinghoffer. But it's interesting. You're just growing up, and I would have never thought that our band would still be walking into Hully Gully, making that record. I would have never thought we'd still be making music or a band 34 years later. Not in a million. I thought, 5 years, 6 years, couple records if you're lucky. Because it was pretty volatile back then.
Yeah.
Still, you know, band members leave, there's drugs, there's this, there's that. Everyone has their ups and downs, you know. But if you have this goal, which I think that we somehow all, maybe not as much earlier, but certainly the second time that John came back into our group in 1998, that's the one time that I felt like the Chili Peppers were going to be over. Dave had gone out. Anthony was not around that much. I don't think he was doing too great. And it felt like it was falling apart. Lindy, our manager, had left. He's like, that's it. I've had enough. I can't deal with this anymore. And I think he wanted us to go, no, don't quit. We were like, fine, you should, it's okay. And that was the one time that I felt like, okay, this is probably the end. We'll probably hang it up. We didn't have another guitar player. And then John comes back in the group, and that's when I really felt like we all went, oh, wow, this is like something special, this chemistry that we have as a band, and we have a second chance at it. That's when I felt like we all kind of just stood up and went, wait a minute, we can do this. Let's not take this for granted. This is something special. For whatever reason, Rick, we're put on this planet, all different places and whatever, and we all come together and we make this music that we make, and there's no trying to be like this or preconceived anything. Just get together in a room and what do you got? And bring your whole thing to it. And I think that evolution of people growing up and changing and lives and children and wives and ex-wives, and whatever it is, it's all part of it. It's all part of the big movie. But I think that there's a goal, and there is, you gotta be flexible. You gotta know your role in the group. There's dynamic shifts, there's power shifts, there's a lot of things that happen, but we're all doing it for the same good cause, which is the end result of making this special music that only the four of us can make.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that, the fact that we've been able to persevere and do that in an authentic way, and doing it for the right reasons, doing it from our hearts, doing it because we love it. And we genuinely love to make music together.
Yeah.
We do. Not all the time, but we genuinely do. Because, man, when you go play all over the world and you see people's faces light up with joy, and dads next to kids and whatever, in any country all over the world, it's amazing. And you shouldn't take that for granted. That's a real gift to be able to do that, make people happy for a couple hours. That's awesome. So we have that, but we also still love what we do, maybe more than ever, which is wild.
Yeah.
It hasn't dissipated at all. I mean, I love playing music more than I did. I got so much more to do, and I want to get so much better. And I love playing all the time. And I just did a little tour with Eddie Vedder, I hadn't played in 2.5 years, and played little theaters in New York and Chicago. And the people were just so happy to be there, and their faces. And it was so joyful. It was beautiful. And it's a beautiful thing about music. And I love that connection.
We'll be right back after a break with more from Chad Smith and Rick Rubin. We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin's conversation with Chad Smith.
Any particular Chili Pepper gigs you can remember that stand out in your mind, either as particularly great or particularly bad over the years? What comes up? What do you think of?
What comes up? We played in Japan and there was a typhoon, and we were on stage for that not too long, and the stage fell, and Anthony had his motorcycle accident, he had that big cast and the pins and stuff, so he's in a cast, and the typhoon and the cymbals and the drums are like blowing into me. I remember that not being like a great time, but that was just like weather stuff. That happens all the time. But yeah, the typhoon. I remember playing in... in Green Bay, I think it was on the Mother's Milk tour, and we used to, go on stage scantily clad, and certainly at a certain part of the show, at the end, we would do a song, and in Green Bay, pubic hair in public, not okay, not having it. So the cops chased, I remember they chased Flea, they ended up chasing Flea and I, and we ran out of the gig, and it was cold, and we just tried to ditch the cops and kept running through fields, and we ended up in this guy's house. They never caught us, and we ended up playing, video games in this guy's house that we just, knocked on the door and said, Can you come let us in? And we're naked.
Incredible.
Maybe we'd found something at that point. A leaf. No.
Do you remember those times fondly or like?
I do. Yes, I do. Well, and we got away with it.
Yeah.
So to speak, or whomever. Oh, no, I do, because it was like an innocent time, you know? It was like, it didn't matter. We're not hurting anybody.
And it was fun. It was like you were having fun. You didn't like the next day is like, oh, we can never let that happen again. There was no regret. It was just...
No, not at that time. No, certainly not. I mean, it was just what we did. It was, we were kids and we were having fun. Yeah. And we were open about everything. And as long as you're not hurting anybody or hurting yourself, you know, the way we express ourselves on stage or with our music, it's all good.
Talk about a little bit about what life on the road is like from, how does it come, like how, from where you guys started to now, the difference in how
Why
that
do
works.
Why you want to know all these way back when and to
well, it's
now?
Just, it's interesting. It's interesting I know. Like the progress and when things change and how they change.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we go from a little, you know, before me, it was station wagons and vans, but they're just playing clubs. And yeah, for Mother's Milk, we had first tour bus, which was like a big deal. Big deal.
Yeah.
We had done little Southwind is like a, you know.
Like a camper, yeah.
It's like a camper. Not as great.
Yeah.
This is an actual tour bus with a driver that just takes speed all the time. We had 17 people on our bus, a 12-person bus. We had the T-shirt girl, and we had two background singers that took the back lounge. And, you know, if there was a place to sleep or crash, it was taken. And then we had a crazy bus driver, you know, and it smelled like, you know, I mean, it was not a good. But we have a bus. This is amazing. This is the coolest thing. That's my tour bus. Wow.
And what were the venues you were playing at that time?
Ooh, we were playing bigger clubs, some theaters, but I'd say 1,500 when we probably started out with Mother's Milk. And, you know, we could get lucky in bigger cities and maybe play two nights or play a bigger place. But 3,000, 4,000 max. We came back here at the end of the tour and the record had done pretty good for us. And, you know, Higher Ground was on MTV and all that stuff. And we played the Greek Theater.
I think was at sold that show.
You were at that show. That's right.
I don't know if I talked to you or met you at that show, but
I don't think so. All I remember is Axl Rose came back and hung out with us. And I was like, oh, wow. And we took a picture with Axl Rose. But do you remember, did you get there and see David St. Hubbins from Spinal Tap introduce us?
I do.
That, we were like, because we were really into Spinal Tap at that point. We're like, oh man, this is the greatest thing ever. He was great. But that was like a big show for, I mean, his hometown show, but that, we did play the Palladium, but like that's LA. Like, but, and, you know, if we would go to, you know, Minneapolis or something, we're playing like Prince's Club and places like that, which is great.
Yeah.
Loved it. It was so exciting. And our record was doing well. Like, you know, I remember we're in the top 40, the Chili Peppers. Are you fucking kidding me? Yeah. Amazing. So that was a great experience going to Europe. Incredible for me. First time. Unbelievable. And then, you know, we came back and wrote and made all those records. And then everything changed when Blood Sugar came around and the music changed. And we got really popular, which was great. John was not enjoying that aspect of it. And so that touring bit should have been like really great. But as you know, the four of us on stage, if we're not all, we all have to be connecting.
Yep.
And he was not wanting to be there. And this just went on and on and on. And he finally left in Japan. I'm going home now. God, we have a show like 2 hours in Yokohama. I know I have to go home now. But, you know, we've been lucky to be able to keep playing at a high level, which is really important to us. We want people to come and leave and go, oh my God, it's the greatest rock and roll band I've ever seen. And we take a lot of pride in that. That has never waned. Now, instead of, you know, getting chased by the cops in Green Bay, and we do everything that we can do to ensure that we can perform at a top level. we're not spring chickens anymore. And, you know, that's really important. And our lifestyles have changed. And I stopped drinking and doing drugs 12 years ago. And I want to be able to perform at the best that I can be. And so everything's geared toward that. It's getting good rest and how you eat and exercise. But I still love to go out and just see everybody. They're all coming. It's amazing. They still coming to see us. And I just want to really do well. I want the band to feel really confident and know that they can look back and they like, I could do whatever I want. This guy's got it. He's got us.
It's great.
Yeah, that's really important to me. And then that energy just goes out to the crowd. And so that's the most important thing.
I saw from the audience perspective, the most dramatic show that I saw was the Hyde Park series. It was
right.
Five shows. I think it was 80,000 people every day for 5 days in a row. And it totaled, it was, I don't know if it's been surpassed since, but it was the biggest concert. Biggest concerts in the history of the UK at that time.
At that time.
I have no idea since.
I think we beat Queen or something. Yeah, no, it was amazing. Yeah.
And I just remember the feeling of, you know, 80,000 people singing along with every word of every song, and every song were ones that we worked on together. It was such a surreal feeling of people really like it. It's a great feeling.
Isn't it?
It is.
It is.
And I'll say, we don't make it for that, but the fact that it happens is radical and so cool.
I know. I mean, 100%. That's the thing. People, you know, do you listen? You think about this song, or you want to play one like that? It's like, no, we just make songs that we're happy with, that make us happy, mm-hmm. that we like. And then it goes out, and hopefully everyone connects with it or doesn't. If they don't, that's okay. But we love it.
Yeah.
You know, not all of them the same amount, but like, we're pretty happy with the records that we make. I am. I know that.
Yeah, me too.
And you are. I know that. So it's absolutely. Like, that's where you start. And then it's just like gravy when you just go play and all of a sudden, like, you get people singing along to your songs. There's nothing but, you know, you make a little song in your garage and then you go to Estonia and the whole crowd is singing along.
Surreal.
It's amazing.
Surreal.
It really is. I'm so glad that you got to go to those shows. You know, the other surreal thing was James Brown was playing with us.
I remember.
Which was wild. And James, we went to a Mojo award show prior to the Hyde Park shows, and we got an award for something, and James was probably getting a Lifetime Achievement Award, and we're taking pictures afterward, and it's Jimmy Page, and all my heroes are standing around, Roger Daltrey and this and that. James Brown is there, and we hadn't played with him yet. And so he's in a blue sharkskin suit, and the hair is slicked back, and it's shiny. His teeth, the headlights, the brights are out. James Brown, not a tall man. I'm 6'3". So I come up to him, and I'm kind of nervous. Oh, Mr. Brown, I'm going to call him Mr. Brown. Chad, I'm the drummer with the Chili Peppers. Thank you so much for playing these concerts with us. It's such an honor. Thank you. He says, hey, man, and it was hard to understand him, I have to say. He says, hey, man, I was kind of trying to listen. And he goes, I got two pieces of advice for you. Why don't you give me some advice? Great. Number one, when you come to the gig, in his James Brown voice, I can't really do it. But when you get to the gig, always back your car, because you never know when you got to get the fuck out.
Good advice.
Good advice. Like probably going back to the chilling circuit stuff. Yeah. If there's some weird shit happening in the bar,
you gotta get out.
You gotta get out.
Yeah.
And always take your wallet to the stage. Yeah.
It's good. Good advice.
Sage advice from Mr. Brown. But those concerts were amazing. But I remember one of the nights, I look over on the side of the stage to my left, and there's Roger and Brian from Queen, and Roger with his kids. Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull.
Wow.
Tony from Sabbath. Jimmy Page. I'm trying to think if there were any, you know, rock English royalty over there. And I'm just like, all right, I got a gig to do here. I'm not going to look over here. I'm going to keep focused here. He was on John's side. Poor John. I don't know if he really. But, yeah, I knew that, like, something was happening because, like, it was one of those things. Like, why are we playing all these nights and selling out at this giant thing? And why are all, like, the gods of rock over here? Something going on.
Amazing. Talk about the nature of Flea and Anthony's relationship from what you remember when you joined to now. It's fascinating. One thing that I learned in the conversation with Flea that I never really thought about before is that their relationship was bonded pre-music.
Yeah.
So they were just friends first, and then music came into it. So their connection isn't a connection over music. It's just as people. Fascinating.
Yeah, no, and which is, I think, speaks a lot for their relationship and the longevity of it and the love for each other. Yeah, Anthony loves to tell me he had some guy in a headlock in like ninth grade or something, and Flea's like, hey. And Anthony's like, whoa. And that was it. That's how they started hanging out. Yeah, Anthony used to MC for What Is This? He would bring on the band, I think. Flea's band with Jack, and I think Hillel was, they were all, the pre-Chili Peppers. And I think Anthony used to kind of MC the band. When I joined, yeah, of course, and all this is, I don't know any really of the history. And John, being so young, he was like Anthony's shadow. You know, whatever Anthony did or wanted to do or da-da-da-da, I mean, they were inseparable. They hung. So Flea and I, and back then we would room together. You know, it wasn't everybody have his own room. It was you split up two guys. And I think that they were having a little, you know, at the beginning, the dynamic, it was a little tough. I think maybe Flea felt like, I don't know, you can speak to this better than me, but I get the feeling that he was probably like, you know, the new guy, and that's his, now he's like with John. And I don't know if he felt like it hurt his feelings or anything, but there's always a little power struggle. And that's completely normal.
Yeah.
And you have very strong personalities in this band. Everybody, which is great. But you're going to butt heads. And, you know, in the old days, it would be like, fuck you. And you don't talk to the guy for 2 days. Now we talk it out. We figure it out. We don't sulk and be grumpy or ice somebody, you know. I think we've grown up, and I've seen that with them too. And they're always going to be best of friends.
Yeah.
Your lives change, your priorities change, you get families, you have this, you have that, you grow up. Fucking almost 60 years old, for God's sake. But they have a connection like nobody that I've ever seen before that I've been around. And it's not just the music connection, it's part of it.
Yeah.
It's a big part of it.
Yeah, it is now, but it didn't stem from that, and it doesn't feel like that's what drives it. It feels like they're just...
They would be hanging... If they weren't playing music together, they would still be hanging out.
Yeah.
Let's go surf. Let's go do this. So they have a lot of... They're very similar in some ways. Some ways, very different, of course.
Yeah.
But the core of it is that bond and that friendship, you know?
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah, I think of them as wildly different from each other, but also probably more similar than they are to anybody else.
Yeah, because they really, they don't suffer squares, those guys. They like freaks.
Yeah. And they come from the same place, so they share like a worldview that, because of the way they came up together in the streets of Hollywood, they just have a sense of the world that's how they see it. And it's different than everybody else.
Yeah. And that shapes a lot of things. And you know, it's great, but they're kind and they're caring and they're good dads. And the value part, you know, is important. And growing up and seeing the world and doing great things that you can do and flee school and all. I mean, I'm so proud of him. I think he's amazing. And Anthony, you know, as well, just like, you know, I'm proud of those guys. I'm proud of our group and what we do and what we stand for. And we put positive energy out in the world. And those guys, are, you know, they're the face of the band. So it's like, it's important. And they're amazing.
Tell me a little bit about your experience of John coming back this time and writing the writing process for this album and the recording for this album. Just talk about this album a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, how was it? I think Anthony said, you know, come on over. And he's like, what do you think of John coming back in the band? I was like, what? I mean, the first time he came back in the band, I really thought it was crazy. But this is 10 years now. I really thought that ship had sailed. And I was like, what? And he's like, they kind of been hanging out a little bit. And I was like, are you on good terms? Everything okay? And he was like, yeah, yep, we're good. I said, okay. So I just wanted to talk to John to see the obvious question, why do you want to come back in the band? So Flea and I went over to his house, and I hadn't seen John in a long time, long time. Once in a while, we'd text each other, but a long time, probably 7 years at least. And he said, well, I want to play music again, and I want to play guitar in a band, and the only band I want to be in is the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I go, but when you left, you were like, didn't want to do all the things that you got to be. Do you remember all the stuff you got to do to be in a band, right? It's not just writing the songs and recording. It's the touring and the press and the videos and the this and the that and the travel. And he seemed more self-aware to me. Like, he seemed, you know, that he, like, understood what it takes. He knows what it takes, but that he was prepared for it. Mm-hmm. And that he wanted to do it. And he really wanted to play.
Yeah.
And that won me over. I was like, okay. I mean, you never know with anyone. And, you know, look, this is the third time he's been in our group. But to go back to what I was saying before, we do have this special thing.
Yeah.
And I love Josh, and he's a great musician. But we do have a special chemistry with John. And I think that we have more music to make and more experiences to have. And it was the timing felt right.
Do you remember the first time you were in the room playing together?
Yeah.
Was the first time the whole group together, or did you jam with John?
No, we were all together. We were at the place in Beverly Glen that we were at very briefly.
This was during the lockdown or not yet? Was the lockdown
Before.
Already happening? Okay.
No, it was in mid to late January.
Okay.
And we just jammed. We didn't play any songs. We just kind of jammed. And he's like, I haven't stood up and played guitar in a long time. You know, and it's like dancing with someone. You know, you used to your dance partner, and then you're like, okay, and then, oh, well, and you kind of figure it out for a minute. Like, Flea and I, we've been dancing a long time. John, we just had to kind of acclimate a little bit to, like, each other's thing.
Yeah.
And didn't take long, though. And he was really interesting to me. He didn't want to play. We didn't start trying to write songs right away. We just jammed. And then he wanted to play old songs, like old blues songs. And, you know, John has such a vast, you know, vocabulary of music that he loves. And he would just say, hey, guys, you want to learn this one and this one, this one. And so we would learn them and play those. Then as a little bit time went by, he wanted to just play, because we thought we were going to have to do some gigs that eventually got canceled, which was great for us. But he wanted to just play old Chili Pepper songs, not anyone before him or I joined, like from the first and second and third album. He wanted to play Green Heaven and Get Up and Jump and, you know, Mommy Where's Daddy. And he didn't want to play anything that he had played on or we had played on. And you know, that first couple of days, I was like, okay, well, we'll learn Love Trilogy. Okay, we haven't played it in like 25 years, but okay.
Were those things that you guys had played on tour when you first joined the band, or not so much?
Maybe. When I first joined, we Mother's Milk, we had to play a lot of the older songs, but right. But there were some that were like just random. And what my conclusion was, and John could speak for it better, but I feel like he was trying to reconnect with the reason why he fell in love with the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Mm-hmm. That's just my take of it. And then we started the usual process. Jam, who's got an idea? Oh, I had this bass line. Oh, I had this thing from home. Da 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 da. And we just started writing. And pandemic hit, of course, which was a bummer for everybody in the world, but we could just be in this place, the four of us. We got to write and do our thing for, we were at that point, like, who knows how long, just go with no interruption, nothing. And that, what a, you know, we're so fortunate to have that experience,
yeah,
and have that outlet in such dark, weird times. So that was great. And so we just kept writing, and until we saw you, and you came down to the Village that one day, but that wasn't until like September or something, I think, right? So that was, yeah, 8 months, 9 months or something.
Something like that.
Yeah, it was great. You were just for walking around, just like with a big smile on your face. You look so happy. You're like, oh my God, these guys are back together. I can't believe this. That's the feeling I got seeing you just kind of walk around the room while we were just playing our songs. We didn't play them for anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, they weren't all done or everybody, yeah, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And you're just like, great, great. Sounds great. Yeah,
it wasn't even about the material yet. It was just the feeling of you guys playing together sounded magical. You know, it wasn't whether, are these songs good enough yet? It wasn't that at all. It was just a feeling, right, of like hearing the interaction of the playing and the bass lines and the chord structures, and it just like, wow, it's such a familiar feeling. It was like all new material, but a familiar flavor,
yep,
coming from people I love. So it was very exciting to feel. I remember crying. You know, it made me cry.
Oh, that was awesome. Yeah, I mean, you felt like this sounds like these four guys.
Yeah.
Were you apprehensive? Did you were like, oh, what if I go? Yeah.
No. I was excited to hear, but I again, have no idea what I'm going to walk into.
Right.
I have a funny story to tell from the first time that John quit.
Yeah.
I can't remember how long that window was where he wasn't in the band, but sometime during that time, towards the end of it, I went to, I think it was LACMA. It was a museum, had a film festival of Louis Buñuel movies. And I remember I took a Buñuel class when I went to school. I loved Buñuel. And I went to the Buñuel movie, and the movie ended, and I walked out, and someone came over to me, and it was this kind of plump guy wearing a sport jacket, like something that like substitute teachers used to wear. It was like a woven sport jacket.
Is that at the substitute teacher's clothing store that you go to that you buy that?
I don't know. I just, the only people I've ever seen wear this type of jacket was like substitute teacher in class.
Right.
And he looked at me and he's like, it's John. And it's like, what do you mean? John who? I'm looking right in his face like, John who? It's like, it was John Frusciante. He was unrecognizable.
Wow.
Unrecognizable.
I remember that.
And I was so happy to see him, just because I loved him, and the time I'd seen him before that, it seemed like I might never see him again, because before that he was, you know, probably weighed, you know, 80 pounds,
yes,
and was in a room covered in blood and vomit.
Right.
So it didn't seem like this was different.
Yeah.
But it was shocking to see him look so different. And I was so happy to see him. And he, right, seemed great. Like he was,
yeah,
just in a great mood, but really upbeat. And I was so happy to see him upbeat. The fact that he was coming out to see a movie was a good sign. Like everything about it was great.
Right.
I don't remember how long after that he ended up rejoining that first time.
Yeah. I don't know anybody like him.
No.
He's a unique individual.
Yeah.
Best musician I've ever played with. I mean, I played with some good ones.
Yeah.
I mean, the most unique for sure. And especially on his instrument, I mean, he's amazing. And, you know, and he just goes for it. Whatever it is,
yep,
he focuses on that, laser focus. And you know, it's music or it's drugs or it's this or that or painting. And, you know, that's just who he is. And right now he's, as you know, he's dedicated, man. He's into everything, into it, all aspects of the music and the band and the thing. And it makes you up your game, you know,
for
being,
sure,
around people like that. Yeah, of course. But as you mentioned, I saw him in many different phases, and yeah, I thought for sure that he was not going to make it. And I remember seeing him at the Viper Room with like, and I came and he was playing acoustic guitar, and he had not many teeth.
Yeah.
And I saw him in the back, and I walk in the little dressing room in the Viper room, real quiet, little dark little room, and somebody hits me in the back and goes, "Hey, fucker." And I look around, and I was like, "You." I was like, "Who's this?" Did not recognize him.
Unrecognizable.
2 feet away.
Yeah.
It was a little dark, but from here to here. I'm like, "What the fuck are you?"
Yeah.
And then I went, "Holy shit." His hair was really dark, but what an amazing transformation. And, you know, what's great, Rick, is that another great thing about this is we get to make music together, make a lot of music, a lot of great music. And then we get to go play concerts with him. A lot of people have never seen him play with us before. And then the ones that have, they probably never thought they would again. And
yeah.
And so it'd be really exciting. And of course, not being able to play any concerts for 2.5 years almost. So this is going to be pretty, when June rolls around, it's going to be pretty, pretty exciting.
I was so lucky to participate in this thing. You know, it's like it's a crazy thing. We get to be part of this thing.
Rick, I want your listeners to know that you are, we couldn't do it without you. We really could. We could do it, but it would not be what it is. And you bring it.
Thank you. Still,
you're welcome.
What I'm saying is the fact that all of us get to have this experience of making something and people caring about it is unbelievable, that this is the life we get to live. It's unbelievable. And
right?
And how odd it is when, like you said, coming from the garage, making things that you like, that's all it has ever been.
Yeah.
You know, for me, my dorm room, making things I like. That's all it ever was. Just trying to make something that I like, that I was excited to play for my friend. That's all. Nothing more than that.
And you keep it that way.
It's always been.
Right?
Always been that.
And always been that. And that's the authentic thing, I believe, along with what the music is, that connects with people. Because it's not trying to be something that it isn't, other than what is real to me and what I'm trying to do, or what we're trying to do as a group. And that's what connects with people. I gotta think that's what it is, because it's what we've done the whole time. And it's still connecting. For some odd reason, we're still relevant to people. Little kids come up to me and sing songs off of our record. My kids are singing Black Summer.
It's a trip.
I know. It's great.
Yeah.
You know what? Enjoyed this immensely. It's nice to see your face.
Same.
I got three guys waiting to jam, and then when finals show up.
Go make it happen. This was great. Thank you so much for doing this.
Of course.
Send my love to the lads.
I will. I just texted Gator and said, I'll be a little late. I'm talking to Rick. No problem. All good.
Cool, man. Have fun.
I will. Thank you, Rick.
You too. Bye.
Big thanks to Chad Smith for breaking down his history with the Red Hot Chili Peppers and talking about his life before joining the band. You can hear the Chili Peppers' new album, Unlimited Love, along with all of our favorite songs of theirs, on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee and also Shangri-La Studios. Our executive producer is Mila Bell. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to Musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today. The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored amongst some of the most influential leaders in industry. And me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventionalawards. See you there.